Hello, it's Michael Steed here from Kaplan Financial, and today I'm presenting a podcast on topical tax issues. But it's a podcast with a difference. It comes with a slide pack that you can view. I will be speaking as we move through the slide pack, and please turn to the next slide when you hear the following noise. Right, let's go. What are we going to be talking about today? The contents are as follows. Budget 2009 and some of the fallout from the 2008 pre-budget report. We're also going to be taking a look at some self-assessment issues having gone through the first 31st of January, where we were forced to file online. I'm going to be looking at some business tax and some corporation tax. We're also going to be looking at reform to the taxation of cars, capital gains tax, we're going to take a quick look at the updated position on there, and finally some VAT update points. Let's start with the budget and the 2008 pre-budget report. The 2009 budget has been confirmed for the 22nd of April. It's almost never been this late. So why is it late? Is Gordon and Alistair playing for time? The answer seems to be yes. As we all know, the economy is in poor state, and the financial services have managed to run us into a train wreck at the end of the line. But he hasn't got all the time in the world. He still needs royal assent before mid-July, if for no other reason than Parliament goes into its summer recess just after. Let's have a look at some possible budget issues. It's expected that Alistair Darling will confirm the tax allowances and rates for 2009-10 right through to 2011-12, and also the national insurance rates. And we need to note the massive hikes announced to national insurance in the late 2008 pre-budget report. And these are due, as we will see, to come into play in 2011-12. But let's review what we know so far. Let's start with personal allowances. The personal allowance for 2008-09 finally settled, as you will recall, at just over £6,035. We all know about the 10% income tax ban farce, and as a result, after a lot of arguing and a lot of unhappiness from Labour backbenchers, we finally settled on that number. For the next year, we do have the personal allowance, and it has been set at £6,475. And you can see that number on HMRC's website on the pre-budget report notices, and it's notice number one. That's quite an interesting rise. It's about £130 above inflation. Now, the personal allowance has not yet been set for 2010-11, but we expect it to be around £6,800. What is interesting is Alistair Darling's proposal in the 2008 pre-budget report and expected to be confirmed in the 2009 budget that we're going to have new allowances from 2010-11 for high earners. We're talking here about people with a gross income above £100,000. And they're expected to have a reduction in their personal allowance of £1 for every £2 excess above the magic £100,000 number. But it has been pegged at 50% of the full personal allowance. The worst news is for those with gross income above £140,000. They have a further reduction of £1 for each £2. So, what does that mean? Let's have a look at some examples, and I've chosen on this slide three. We've got A, who earns £104,000, B, who earns £108,000, and C, who earns £110,000. Remember, I'm making a reasonable assumption here of a personal allowance of £6,800. If A has gross income of £104,000, his personal allowance will reduce by one half of the excess. So his reduction will be one half of £4,000. His personal allowance will therefore be £6,800 less 2,000, that is £4,800. B has gross income of £108,000, so his personal allowance will reduce by 4,000, that is one half of the excess above 100. But as the reduction cannot be more than half of the full value of the personal allowance, his personal allowance will be capped at 3,400. C, by contrast, has gross income of £110,000, and his personal allowance will similarly cut to 50% of the full rate, but no more. Let's have a look at somebody who earns over £140,000. They have a further reduction of £1 for every £2 excess, as you'll recall. So what would it be for somebody who earned £180,000? Well, I think effectively that anybody with an income over 140 will have no personal allowance at all. This is expected to only affect the top 1% of the earning population. So, presumably in the Chancellor's mind, this will include all those evil bankers who have brought the world to its economic knees. So what about some age allowances here? These are pre-announced. We have the numbers for 08-09 and 09-10. If you're between 65 and 74, we have 9,030 and 9,490 respectively, and you'll recall that age allowances for somebody who's 75 and over in any year, those for 08-09 and 09-10 are 9,180 and 9,695 respectively. Remember, please, that age allowances are means tested, and very rich pensioners will have just the normal personal allowances, and extremely rich pensioners will be subject to the new rules from 2010-11 for high earners. Let's now turn to some basic income tax. The pre-budget report confirmed, and it's expected that the budget 2009 will also confirm, the basic two-rate system will be kept at 20% for basic rate taxpayers and 40% for higher rate taxpayers. You'll recall that income is divided into non-savings, that's your salary, and perhaps a little bit of buy-to-let income. Savings income, that means income from banks, not that there's a lot of that around at the moment with the rates being so low, and dividend income. And similarly, there aren't too many people receiving dividends, especially from the banks. But what was announced, and is expected to be confirmed, that there is a new rate of tax on non-savings and savings, that's your salary and your bank interest, of 45% above £150,000 of taxable income. So what about tax on dividends? From 2011-12, there will be three rates of tax on dividends. The basic rate, that'll remain at 10%. And remember, you get a credit, so basic rate taxpayers effectively have a rate of tax of 0% on their dividends. And that as much affects dividends from their own personal family companies as it would do from normal high street enterprises. The higher rate, up to £150,000 of taxable income, remains at 32.5%. That's the funny fixed factor rate, remember, and you're still able to have your 10% credit, which means that the effective rate on dividend income for higher rate taxpayers is 25% of the net. That's 22.5% of the gross. Those two numbers are, of course, the same. But what is new is the new rate of 37.5% on dividends above £150,000. Let's now take a look at national insurance. For a long while, Gordon, and now his successor Alistair, has been looking to align the income tax system and the national insurance system. It's well known that national insurance has never fitted particularly comfortably with its bigger brother income tax, but we're expecting alignment as the years go on. Not only that, but rather ominously, Alistair Darling announced in the pre-budget report that there would be NIC increases across the board from 2011-12. One of the big problems about national insurance is actually understanding the language. When you go onto HMRC's website and you look at all the strange titles there, it makes you scratch your head. So let's just remind ourselves, while we're still on this slide, what we've actually got. Starting from the bottom, we have the lower earnings limit, and then above that, the primary threshold, and then above that, the upper earnings limit. Now, below the lower earnings limit, that is at the bottom of this slide, there is no national insurance due. But once you've achieved that level and you are between the lower earnings limit and the primary threshold, there are no effective NICs due, but importantly, you preserve your rights to a state pension. Once you're paid above the primary threshold, you will pay at the main rate, and you will continue paying at the main rate, all the way up to the upper earnings limit, the UEL. And then above that, you will be paying at the additional rate. So, let's see how that works. Let's have a look at Alistair's proposed increases across the board from 2011-12. For an employed earner, let's start at the bottom there, lower earnings limit, up to the primary threshold, what has changed or what will change is that the main rate has gone up by 0.5%. And remember, this is for the primary national insurance contributions, that is the one that the earner, the employee, pay themselves. So just see that one again. It's gone from 11% to 11.5%. All the way up, of course, to the upper earnings limit. And the additional rate, which we've had for a couple of years now, formerly at 1%, will be rising to 1.5%. So it's pretty clear that for an employed earner, they will be seeing some increases from 2011-12. As far as the employer's contribution, and remember that's the secondary class one, we've had that at 12.8% above the limit for quite a while now. And Alistair's proposal is that from 2011-12, that will be rising from 12.8% to 13.3%. So what does it look for a self-employed earner? Well, you can see again that the language is pretty similar there. And starting on this slide at the bottom, lower earnings limit, primary threshold, upper earnings limit, and then the additional rate. So we've got pretty much the same language. But what has changed, or what will change, is the rate at which self-employed earners will be paying on their NICs. The main rate is expected to rise from 8% to 8.5%, and the additional rate will rise from 1% to 1.5%. Okay, well that's it for personal income tax and national insurance as far as the rates are concerned. Let's now move and have a quick look at the proposals for the reform of the taxation of cars. This is Alistair's proposal, formerly Gordon's, where they've been saying for some while that they want cars taxed on a more green basis. So let's have a look at what these proposals are. Let's start then with the reform of taxation on expensive cars. Previously announced by Gordon, new rules on expensive cars from April 2009. What do we mean by expensive? Well, it's very simple. Expensive means cars costing more than £12,000. And for some while, and it'll come as no surprise to you, that there's been a restriction on the writing down allowance to a maximum of £3,000. That is one quarter of £12,000. But what's actually going to be happening in these new rules? As expected, it's gone green. It's all about CO2 emissions. Now, remind yourself that in the new 2008 capital allowances regime, and we will be talking about those a little bit later on, we have the two pools. From April 2008, there is a 20% pool and a 10% pool. We've lost the 25, and we've lost the long life asset pool at 6%. So, what's going to be happening under these new rules? Well, if you're moderately green, that's your car, up to 160 grams per kilometre, they are going to be placed in the 20% pool. But anything that's a bit ungreen, verging towards brown on the colour spectrum, over 160 grams per kilometre, they are being consigned to the 10% pool. Now, that's obviously going to be working for, say, an employer, a company which has no private use adjustments on their cars. But if you're an unincorporated business and the cars are being used for a mixture of business and personal use, then clearly you're going to have to adjust as normal. And the proposal is, and expected to be confirmed in this year's budget in April 2009, that there will be a single asset pool for non-business use. In other words, you allocate into either the 20% pool or the 10% pool, and then you adjust for your private use. Let's remind ourselves too about what's happening about business mileage rates when an employee has a car provided and they then make a claim only for business miles on their petrol. We've been used to, for some time now, HMRC announcing about every 6 months that the numbers change according to basically the price of petrol on the forecourt. Now, last year, and you can see from this slide, July 2008, the numbers spiked, which reflected the incredible increase in the price of oil in the summer. But for the first time, these numbers have dropped back. If you look at this slide carefully, you can see we've got effectively three columns: petrol, diesel, and LPG. And on the left-hand side, still rated by engine size, 1400cc or less, up to 2000, and over 2000. And in each of these columns, I've laid out the new numbers, that is the numbers from the 1st of January 2009, and compare those to the numbers when they were last adjusted, that is in July 2008. And you can see that they've pretty much dropped across the board. Interesting. Last year, they were going up to reflect the price of oil. Well, that's enough on cars now. Let's have a look at some business taxation issues and see what the picture is looking like in the very early months of 2009. I'd like to start with some business tax measures. Sadly, in the current state of the economy, businesses across the board are likely to incur losses, although hopefully most of the AAT clients won't be on the scale of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Let's start with losses in unincorporated businesses. We've got a new one-year carry-back extended to 3 years rule announced in the pre-budget report and again expected to be confirmed in the April 22nd budget in 2009. Now, what have we had for a while? We've had new startup businesses have been able to carry back trading losses in the early years of their new trade to pre-existing income. Now, that's pre-existing and is not expected to change. That's useful where, for example, somebody who's been on a moderate salary and paying some tax decides to go it alone, and he or she then exposed to the rigours of the real world may be incurring losses in the early years. It enables them to, as it were, fold back the losses in the early years of their new business against their old employment income and that will rather usefully trigger tax repayments. One last thing on this slide, of course, at the bottom, is to remind yourself that we've always had the carry forward of losses against profits of the same trade, and they can be taken forward for as long as you like, but they've got to be used quickly. So the net upshot of that is that people will still be using the carry forward of losses, but not if they can generate instant tax repayments by folding them back. So there's a clear priority there. This 3-year carryback, as announced in the pre-budget report, is for 1 year only and will apply to trading losses incurred in the 2009-10 tax year. That's from, of course, April 2009 onwards. You've always been able to carry back unlimited losses for the first year, and with the extension to the next 2 years, making the total of the new 3, Alistair has restricted it, and he's given us a maximum of £50,000 over the next 2 years, with the later years coming first. On to something else for business taxation. For a while now, we've had people availing themselves, and I think with good reason, there is a helpline for people who are struggling to pay their tax, and it is the new Business Payment Support Service and can be viewed on the front page of HMRC's website. There is a new telephone support line and they will give you quick decisions, and I've had clients already struggling to pay their bills in January 2009 have availed themselves of that, and the feedback that I get from them is that HMRC are actually fairly happy to help. So if anyone's got any experience of that, give me a call. I'd be very happy to hear your experiences too. Okay, let's move on now and look at some corporation tax issues. For most of our AAT clients, they will be paying tax at the small company's rate. Now, this has had a rather sorry history over the last 4 or 5 years. We've had a 0% ban, then a 10% ban, and then we've had all sorts of funny legislation to stop people doing Arctic systems type planning. So where are we now? Well, there was a proposed rise from 21% to 22% in April 2009, and that was proposed, as you will recall, in the 2007 budget, and it is what Norman Lamont would have referred to as a rising wedge of taxation. But the 21 to 22% rise, which was scheduled for April 2009, has now been postponed. And that was announced in the 2008 pre-budget report and is expected to be confirmed in the April 2009 budget. And if you think about what that's actually worth £500 for a company with profits and profits chargeable to corporation tax of £50,000. Something else that wasn't entirely clear in the pre-budget report and we're hoping will be confirmed in clear language in the April 2009 budget is the smoothing fraction for marginal companies. It's expected to be 7/400ths, but I thought the budget notice was fairly unclear, so it'll be interesting to see what that actually turns out at in the budget in April. The profit limits are likely to remain the same, so no change there. Let's now think about the possibility of a company with losses. A company with losses has always been able to fold back losses, and for the last few years, it's only been for 1 year. But to give the corporation tax the same parity as business tax, the extension to 3 years for business tax is confirmed for companies as well. But there is a time limit on this. It's for company accounting periods that end between the pre-budget report date, which was the 24th of November 2008, and the 23rd of November 2009. Unlimited losses can be carried back 1 year, but for the next 2 years, just like business tax, that has been restricted to £50,000 in total, with the later years first. So, with all this information here, is it worth incorporating? Well, if you look in 2008-09, very rough numbers here, profits of 10,000, incorporation saves around about £450. And as you go up the scale, profits of £50,000, incorporation saves about £3,500. Now, with the delay in the CT rise, in 2009-10, we've got pretty much the same result. We won't have an increase in corporation tax, which will reduce the efficiency of incorporation. So, we're looking at the same numbers. So, is incorporation still desirable? Unquestionably yes for the right clients, and unquestionably no for the wrong clients. We've spoken many times on the Tax Update series about clients who simply cannot handle the administration and responsibilities associated with running a company, and our hands are full enough with them. While we're on that point, the Companies Act 2006 has got a very long implementation timetable, and that's been the subject of another podcast. And that's running through 2009 to final implementation in September 2009. And through 2009, it's going to have an impact on the administration, the reports and the accounts, and many other aspects of running a company. As I said, that will be the subject of another podcast, and we will no doubt touch on that on the Tax Update series. However, if you want a quick look at that, there's a good run-through on the Companies House website, which is worth looking at. Just remind yourself, too, that there are a number of tax issues associated with incorporation, and without doing these to death, because we've spoken about them before, let's just remind ourselves about one or two of them. For income tax, of course, there's cessation, and all the cessation rules will apply. And they simply are that you tax every pound of profit that has not yet been taxed, and you get credit for any overlap relief that's not yet been given. Capital allowances. Remember, in your last year of trade, you are not given capital allowances. Instead, you have balancing events. But it's standard practice to make an election to transfer these to the company at the tax written down value. And remember, that election must be signed by both parties and made to HMRC, very simple letter here, within 2 years. As far as CGT is concerned, we've got some disposals, but there are reliefs available. And they have been the subject, and will be again the subject of another podcast. Stamp duty land tax, a possible impact there. Remember, the SDLT FA 2003 legislation requires transfers to companies to be at market value, which underlines the inefficiency of transferring property to a company. If one of your clients has a property which is held outside the company, then that is much better, because, for amongst other things, you can extract profits from the company by way of rent, and those are national insurance free. And one last point about incorporation tax issues, VAT, it's probably going to be the transfer of a going concern. I say probably because that is a rather tricky area, and it's something that you need to pay attention to. Right, let's address Arctic Systems for a moment or two. One of the great long-running sagas to rival the Icelandic sagas themselves. Budget 2008 announced a one-year postponement of the anti-avoidance rule, and the pre-budget report announced a further postponement of 1 year till April 2009. What exactly is going on here? This, of course, is the attack on what the government calls income shifting. And the original great case of Arctic Systems, Diana and Jeff Jones with their IT consultancy company, where he's out earning the money, she's taking a personal allowance salary. And remember that the revenue had no problems with that whatsoever. It was only when she took 50% of the dividends that they started to get unhappy. So they are introducing a new rule which says that if Mr. Jones puts money into Mrs. Jones' pocket, it will be retaxed on Mr. Jones. That's income shifting. Now, the legislation as introduced didn't work very well at all, and the proposals were simply thrashed by everybody. So HMRC took it all away and said that it would come back in April 2009. However, I think there's a very real possibility that that will be extended in the current climate. I think it would be politically dynamite to have a go in another way at small family businesses. So my expectation, but don't hold my feet to the fire here, is that it could be extended at least one more year. So, what's the advice? That's simple. Make hay while the sun shines. Use personal allowance salaries and basic rate dividend extraction. Use your spouses and your civil partners, although actually remember, you can use anybody you like. Okay, let's move on and have a quick look at residence and domicile issues. Residence and domicile issues have come to the fore in the last year because of the proposals for the attacks on non-domiciled taxpayers. That's people who were born in other countries but who have been in the UK long enough to be considered resident here. Now, on this slide, let's remind ourselves about the key vocabulary. Residence denotes exposure to worldwide income and gains, and that's pretty obvious. Ordinary residence, remember, is a second hook for CGT exposure, and domicile, a very complicated word, for tax purposes, denotes exposure to IHT. The loophole, as perceived by the government, is that people who are non-domiciled, and indeed people who are not ordinarily resident, are able to use what is known as the remittance basis. And the remittance basis is where somebody who is resident in the UK but has income and gains abroad only gets taxed on those incomes and gains when they are brought into the UK, that is, they are remitted to the UK. Now, FA 2008, following on from the 2007 pre-budget report, has introduced some new rules, and we just need to remind ourselves about what they are. Remittance now needs an election. You choose, and you can choose year on year. But remember, the point for us is that all non-doms, regardless of how rich or how poor they are, who choose the remittance basis from April 2008 lose both their personal allowance and their CGT annual exemption. Now, how many of us use the CGT annual exemption? I suspect most people, and myself included, hardly ever use it. But a loss of personal allowance is actually much more damaging. So not only do somebody who's a non-dom, but remember resident in the UK, who chooses the remittance basis will lose their personal allowance and their CGT annual exemption, there's a second stick waiting in the background. Non-doms who have been in the UK for more than 7, and I mean by that resident in the UK for more than 7 out of the previous 10 years, in addition to losing the PA and the CGT annual exemption, will have to pay £30,000 for each year of choosing the remittance basis. And that is known as the RBC, the remittance basis charge. So, who will be affected? It's not just the Mohammed Al-Fayeds and the Roman Abramoviches of this world who will be affected. Let's have a look here at an average AAT profile. This is Peter. He's Greek. He was born in Cyprus. And he's been in the UK for the last 5 years. He has got UK profits in his business of £25,000 per annum. And he's got Greek profits from some property that he owns in Athens of £4,000 per annum. The point's very simple. If you're doing his tax, you've got to consider the choice available to Peter. And he has got to choose. Remember, he is a res non dom, and that's tax techie for saying that he's resident in the UK, but he is a non-domiciled person, and therefore he can choose the remittance. So, what is Peter's choice? It's simple. If he chooses the remittance basis, that is, he won't be taxed on his Greek profits of £4,000 per annum, then he is going to lose his UK personal allowance. If he wishes to put aside the remittance basis and to be taxed like the rest of us on an arising basis, then he will retain his UK personal allowance, but the other side of the coin, of course, is that he will be taxed on his Greek profits of £4,000. And a quick play with a calculator will tell you the levels that we need to be concerned at. Okay, so let's remind ourselves quickly, who becomes resident? How do we become resident? Well, there are two basic tests. One of these has now been put into the Income Tax Act 2007, and it's an insertion from FA 2008. And the first of these, I'm very loosely going to refer to this as the six-month test, actually 183 days. Remember, if you are in the UK for any 183 days, then you will be resident. And if you're resident, then the basic rule, remember, is that you are going to be taxed on your worldwide income and gains. But it would be very easy, wouldn't it, just to come to the UK every year for, say, 182 days, thus beating the rule in the Income Tax Act. There's a second stick here. If you look in the Bible, that is IR20, that's the Inland Revenue Leaflet 20, which is available on HMRC's website, you will see that there is a second test, and that's the 91 days on average over 4 years. So if you visit the UK as part of a regular pattern, that is 3 months give or take over 4 years, then you will be considered to be resident from the beginning of the fifth tax year. Now, how do you do some counting? Well, historically, you've never needed to count the days of arrival or departure. So if you imagine somebody like Philip Green, for example, who comes in from Monaco every week, he would have flown in to the UK on Monday and he would leave on Friday. You wouldn't count the Monday or the Friday, so you'd only count 3 days in any week. But since the rather famous now Robert Gaines Cooper case, which has been chundering through the courts for the last 3 or 4 years and now enshrined in FA 2008, the new rule is that instead of ignoring the days of departure and arrival, you count according to the number of midnights that you spend in the UK. So, back to Philip Green, if he leaves Monaco on a Monday morning, he's going to be in the UK for Monday midnight, Tuesday midnight, Wednesday and Thursday midnights. So whereas before he would have been in the UK for 3 days in every week, he's now 4 days in every week, and the numbers soon mount up, and before you know it, he's in danger of becoming a UK resident. Right, let's have a play with some self-assessment issues. Personal tax filing deadlines, known by everybody. 31st of October for paper and the 31st of January for electronic. And of course, this has been the first year where we've all been required to file after the 31st of October online. How was it for you? According to HMRC, a record number of taxpayers filed their self-assessment tax returns online this year. They reckon that a total of 5.75 million returns were filed online by the 31st of January deadline. And that's a 50% increase on last year. According to their statistics, in all, 67% of self-assessment tax returns were filed online by the deadline this year. 390,000 of those on the busiest day, which was actually the 30th of January. And that's 185,000 more than the previous highest total recorded in the run-up to last year's deadline. Of course, what they don't tell you is that last year it crashed. And as far as I'm aware, it didn't crash this year. And I was indeed working, and I expect most of you were as well, right through to the end of Saturday, the 31st of January, to get the stuff in on time. I love this quote from Mark Holden, director of HMRC's Carter Programme. That sounds great, doesn't it? The Carter Programme, which designed and built the new self-assessment online service. He said, and I quote, "HMRC's self-assessment online service enables people to do business with the government in the way we know they want to." Actually, I don't think we ever saw it that way. I think we were largely forced onto online filing. But I think it's like a lot of these things. Once you're there, you wonder why you didn't do it a few years ago. I filed online this year using HMRC software and a purchased partnership software suite. The partnership suite cost me £25 for up to 5 partnerships, and that was adequate for my needs. For the record, it was from an outfit called Andrika Limited, and I got that from the list of approved HMRC suppliers on the website. And as far as I could tell, it was the cheapest, so in these rather straitened times, that suited me rather well. So how did I find the HMRC suite of software? Well, having gone through it, I probably won't use it next year. And what are the reasons for that? I found that it needed a lot of fixes to make it work. There were some quite basic things. For example, it wouldn't allow filing unless a date of birth was given. And for a few of my clients, I didn't actually have their dates of birth, so it ended up with a few last-minute phone calls to get that on. The other thing I found was that it needed a PAYE reference for the employee page. And as is well known, and I suspect a few of you are like this as well, find that if you have spousal salaries that are below the personal allowance, you may not have a PAYE system set up. And if you haven't got a PAYE system set up, you haven't got a reference, and their system doesn't like that at all. So that's a little bit of a disadvantage. Another reason, an ally to the PAYE issue, is that it wouldn't accept nil tax deducted. So if you had a spouse who was being paid around about £4,500 to £5,000, say, then it wouldn't accept nil tax deducted, so I found that I had to fix that by putting in £1. The other thing I didn't like was I found that the final printout wasn't great looking, and not great to give to clients. It's just basically a list of tick boxes. So, any suggestions there? If anybody has got a software package that they particularly like, I'd like to hear from them, because I'm looking out for something for next year. While we're on self-assessment, let's also remind ourselves about the new penalty regime. This has been coming for some time now, and now we're looking at it in the face. The new penalty regime is for return periods which commence after the 31st of March 08, and where these are filed after the 31st of March 09. And in the first tranche, it covers income tax, CGT, CT, and VAT. So what's that going to affect then? Well, pretty obviously, it's going to affect the 2009 tax returns, in other words, the next season. It will also affect, and let's think of an example here, a VAT return that is the first quarter for 2009, so from the 1st of January 2009 to the 31st of March 2009. That will also be within the new penalty regime. So, what's this all about then? Well, it's a new system designed to correct, and I use that word straight from the website, correct taxpayer behaviour. The new regime will apply as a result of careless or deliberate action. There are a series of graduated penalties that are linked to the amount of tax that has been lost, and also importantly linked to the behaviour of the taxpayer, and finally to the extent of disclosure. Now what about mistakes? Does careless or deliberate cover mistakes? It's not entirely clear yet and we'll have to see how HMRC uses the new system. They've said that they will apply a light touch. Now in this slide, you can see that we've got a table here and we've got some columns. The first one is the taxpayer behaviour. Remember, that's central to the new system. And then the three columns are for no disclosure at all. That's bad behaviour. Prompted disclosure, when they're breathing down your neck, that is. An unprompted disclosure, where you go in and knock on the door. And you can see in the rows there that a careless mistake, a careless error, with no disclosure would attract a penalty of 30%. But if you went in and told them about it, unprompted, that would reduce to zero. And if you let your eye drop down to the southwest corner of that, the worst of the lot is deliberate and concealed behaviour with no disclosure, and it's finally when they put your arm up behind your shoulder blades that you tell them about it. That is very bad in their eyes, and that will attract a 100% penalty. Let's move on and have a look at capital allowances. We, of course, have got a new regime from April 2008. It's supposed to be easier, and there's some buildings expenditure which is now eligible for capital allowances. Expenditure on buildings has always been a problem area, and as the months have developed since this new law has come in, we've seen more upon HMRC's website and indeed on other tax websites as well, and they've given us a clearer picture of what's going on. Plant and machinery in buildings has always been problematic. If, for example, you bought a new building, a new commercial building for your business, and let's say you spent £200,000 on it, the question arises, how much of that £200,000 can I get any tax relief on? Remind yourself that the basic fabric of the buildings is a nothing for tax, and that's not changed. But some parts of the building are now eligible for capital allowances, and they've not been before, and those are referred to as integral fixtures. Remember that you can never get capital allowances on residential property. So if you've got some buy-to-let properties, you're not going to get CAs on those. They are expressly forbidden in the Capital Allowances Act 2001. But the Capital Allowances Act, which is actually a very good act to read, I find it quite a good read. Not that I take it on holiday, mind. They give you three lists, lists A, B and C. The list A is the fabric of building, equals bad. List B are funnies that are not buildings and not plant or machinery. Funny things there like viaducts and runways, so we're not too concerned with those. And it's list C in the Capital Allowances Act that's the one that is potentially of interest. This has got things like the central heating systems, the air conditionings and so on and so forth. Now, the basic shape of the capital allowances system from April 2008 is that the writing down allowances were reduced, and we've already mentioned this earlier in this podcast, from 25 to 20% for plant and machinery. Remind yourself too that as the new system comes in, there's going to be apportionment for accounting periods that straddle April 2008. So, if for example you've got a company which has got a 31st of December year end, then the first 3 months of that will be at the old rate of 25, and the 9 months from the 1st of April onwards will be at the new rate of 20%. So for those of you who will be doing capital allowance calculations on companies with a 31/12/2008 year end, and I expect you'll be doing some of those at the moment, then that's when you're going to have this funny hybrid rate for just that year. And then the year that commences the 1st of January 2009 will be at the single rate of 20%. Now, we've already dealt with expensive cars. Remember, they are based upon 20 or 10%, and it leaves us then, rather interestingly, into the new 10% pool. The 10% pool is for formerly long-life assets, things like printing presses and so forth, things that had an effective economic life of more than 25%. But in the new 10% pool, we've got some new beasties. These are these integral fixtures. They are things like central heating systems. Some of these, formerly at 25% writing down allowance, have fallen to 10. That's the bad news. But some at good news. Water systems, cold water delivery systems, formerly nothing, now able to qualify at 10%. Remind yourself too, and very important to a lot of our AAT clients, is the new annual investment allowance, the AIA. This is set at £50,000 per annum, per business or per group. Now, for most of our clients, they're going to be single businesses, a lot of them are going to be sole traders, some partnerships, and some smaller companies. So, whatever it is, it's £50,000. If you happen to have two or three companies, and they're in a group, it's still £50,000. Now, this is very useful. It's on plant and machinery only, remember? That means a van, but not a car. So, if you've got one of your clients who's going out to buy a new van, let's say £17,000 plus VAT, and assuming they're VAT registered, then they're going to be able to recover the VAT and they're going to write off the whole of the £17,000 under the new annual investment allowance. Now, think about the implications of that. If I write off the whole of £17,000, I am going to depress my profits for that year. Now, they're going to like that, because their tax bill is going to drop, if not disappear. But there is a knock-on effect on that. That will affect their payments on account for the next year. And when the effect of the purchase has blown over, that is 1 year down the line, all of a sudden they're going to see their tax bill rise again with the effect on the payments on account as well. So although they'll see a dip, I think it's professional of us to remind them that they will also see a sudden rise when the effect has blown over. So what do I think about the new AIA? I think it's great news for small businesses, but there is that small scorpion sting in the tail, and I will certainly be telling my clients about those. Let's just quickly think about capital allowances on industrial buildings. Industrial buildings allowances and their compatriots called hotel allowances are being phased out, and they're being phased out over 4 years, and so they're going to be gone from April 2011. Down on my funny little farm in Kent, we have a barn, and that's been eligible for ABAs, that's agricultural buildings allowances, for quite a few years now, and sadly I will be kissing those goodbye. So 4% straight line is what you got, 3% this year, 2% the year after that, 1%, and then finally gone from April 2011. And if you've got clients who have got industrial buildings, then you will know that they will be affected. Some quite big companies here, car manufacturers, for example, as if they're not being savaged enough, are having an extra kick up the backside from the loss of their IBAs. But one thing I'm particularly keen on is the enhanced capital allowances. Remember, these are at 100% on what I'm going to call green technology spend. And there are three boxes that we can think about. Very low emission cars, water saving technology, and I love this one, energy saving technology. Very low emission cars were given 100% capital allowance way back in 2003. And you may recall from the tax update series that I've been banging on about the daughter at college car scheme, by which mum, say, with her own company, remember this needs to be a company because you don't get private use adjustments in the company, can give her daughter a car to go to college with. Brand new car, something with a very low CO2 footprint, a smart car or a Ford Ka or something of that nature. Now, it means that she gets the 100% capital allowance write down in her company, and that's got to be good news. We thought it was going in 2008, and my advice to you all was make hay while the sun shone. But good news, it's been extended. Very slight bit of bad news here. the bar has been dropped. It was formerly cars up to 120 grams per kilometre, and that's slightly dropped to 110 grams per kilometre. The other two members of this list, the water-saving technology and energy-saving technology, sound very, very complicated, and some of them indeed are, but some of them are surprisingly simple. For example, in water-saving technology, rainwater harvesting systems, the sort of B&Q, downpipe converter, and then a water butt, all of that qualifies. If you want some details on this, I firmly recommend that you go to one of the government websites. It's called www.eca.gov.uk, and you've got a good list of all the stuff there, and I think anybody with capital spends should be looking at that. Okay, let's have a look at capital gains tax. What's going on? Let's have a quick look here. From April 2008, of course, we've had a dramatic change to CGT. We've now got a straight 18% flat rate. No longer marginal, no longer added to the top of your income column. In addition, it's goodbye to some old friends. Goodbye to taper relief and goodbye to indexation allowance. It's worth remembering, though, that the loss rules and indeed the major reliefs are unaffected. And right at the bottom, the annual exemption is still in place. But there is something entirely new, and I will be talking about that in just a second, and that's the entrepreneur's relief. But first, let's see how the new rules affect us. Imagine that you went out and bought a buy-to-let for, say, $200,000 in July 1990, and you're selling it now for around $350,000, market permitting. Because you're selling it after April 2008, you will be covered by the new rules. So, no more indexation allowance and no more taper relief. So your CGT calculation is incredibly simple. It's what you sold it for, less what you bought it for. And here, assuming that we are a higher rate taxpayer and you've used your annual exemption, that means for them an increase in tax of around about £4,500. So the new system is not great news. What is new is the entrepreneur's relief. When this new rule system was first announced in the pre-budget report in 2007, there was a pretty extreme reaction to it. And as a result of the loss of the taper relief for serial entrepreneurs, the inhabitants of the mighty dragon's den, the Chancellor introduced this entrepreneur's relief. For those of us old enough to remember it, it looks suspiciously like the old retirement relief. And, in effect, the entrepreneur's relief gives a 10% effective rate of CGT on gains up to £1 million over your lifetime. And to some extent, that restores the pre-April 08 position, where we also had an effective 10% rate after business asset taper relief. So, although the dragons in the den may not like this one too much because of the cap of £1 million, for most of us, a £1 million gain, which we're unlikely to reach in our lifetime, is still going to be pretty good. The entrepreneur's relief covers both assets and shares, so that's good news for sole traders and companies. The business does, however, have to be a trading business and not an investment business, so it's no good for property or financial services, for example. There's no minimum age to qualify, so that's great news for young entrepreneurs. But the only restriction is that you've got to have been trading for 1 year. There are also useful associated disposal rules. Now that sounds a bit complicated, but actually it's dead straightforward. Imagine that you have counseled one of your clients to incorporate, they have their own company, and on your very good advice, they kept the property, let's just say it's an office, outside of the company, and they've been renting that office to the company itself, and hence extracting profits from the company, nicks-free by way of rent. So far, so very good. But let's say that your entrepreneur wants to now sell the company, and at the same time he wants to sell the building. In that case, that under these new rules is referred to as an associated disposal. Still covered by the £1 million lifetime limit, it allows the entrepreneur to dispose of not only the company, but the office as well, and both will be shielded by the umbrella of the entrepreneur's relief. I might add in passing that entrepreneur's relief also applies itself to holiday lets. So if you've got a holiday let trade, then that will also be covered by entrepreneur's relief. Let's now finish our quick review of CGT with a couple of other issues. The first of those are pre-1982 assets, and there are a surprising number of those still around. The basic rule before the new rules were introduced in April 2008 was that if you bought, say, a property or you had some shares that were pre-82, let's say that you acquired them in the late 70s, then you would have a choice for your CGT calculation. You would either value them on the cost basis, or you could go for a 31st of March 1982 value. But the key word was choice. Most times it was effective to choose the March 82 value, although by no means always the case. But what's happening now under the new rules is that that choice has gone. So for anybody with pre-82 assets, they've now got to value those on a 31/3/82 value, and that's the end of the story. As far as share pooling is concerned, remember those in your studies, they are now effectively redundant. Share calculations are much easier, and I will be covering this topic later in the year. Very useful in CGT, of course, interspousal transfers. They're still there and definitely worth using. Remember that also applies to civil partners. And these can be used to transfer assets to, say, a wife if she's at home on maternity leave. So, very straightforward scenario, if you've got madam at home looking after the children for a few years and raising them before they go to school, and sir is away working, and let's just say he's a 40% taxpayer, of course it makes sense to put shares in her name and buy-to-let assets as well. So in the years that she is not earning, then we can take advantage of her lower tax rates and indeed her personal allowances and CGT annual exemptions as well. Let's now move on to the last of my topics, the mighty VAT. Of course, the news that's still with us is the reduced rate of the standard rate from 17.5% to 15% from the 1st of December 2008. Remind yourselves that this is only for 13 months. So the 17.5% rate will be reintroduced from the 1st of January 2010. Now, there's been lots of argument raging about how effective that reduction has been. And I don't propose to deal with that, but I would like to advise that we take care with the transitional rules on the step down and also on the step up at the end of 2009. There's actually quite a good article on that on HMRC's website, and that's available as a PDF download on the effect of the change. It's good for both ends. So, for example, if you're dealing with retail schemes or you're dealing with deposits, cash accounting, flat rate scheme, whatever it is, I think this is a very sound read and I do recommend it. VAT correction of errors rules changed in 2008, and already I'm finding with my clients that this is very useful. For a long time, the error correction bar was set at £2,000. Far too low in the modern world. Remember, this £2,000 limit is for net errors. Net errors, that is, you set off money you owe them and money that they effectively owe you. And the good news is that that £2,000 limit has been effectively raised to £10,000. That is for accounting periods starting on or after the 1st of May 2008. As I said, I've already found that quite useful, and I'm sure you will as well. Finally then, on VAT, revised fuel scale charges, they're expected again on the 1st of May, remember, unlike the approved rates for company cars for direct tax purposes, the VAT rates tend to change only once a year, and they're expected on the 1st of May 2009, and I mean by that accounting periods beginning on or after the 1st of May. And we hope to see that sometime around the budget in April. Okay, that's the end of my podcast. I hope it's been useful, and I look forward to seeing you all on the Tax Update series after the budget. Cheerio.